Hey there, I'm so pumped to tell you about an amazing new community I've launched called Grief to Growth Circle Community. It's a space for people who are grieving to come together to support each other and for people who want to know who we are, why we're here, and where we're going to have those conversations, all the things we talk about on the podcast. So I invite you to join me at grieftogrowth.com/community to become part of this compassionate crew. The best part is 100% free. And you have access to me in addition to everybody else in the community. In fact, the podcast will be there so you can talk about the things we talk about in the podcast right there in the community. There's also some premium content if you want to go deeper in the work I'm doing, but mostly it's about building relationships and community and about sharing resources and supporting each other. So come on over and check it out. It's grieftogrowth.com/community. I'll see you inside.
Hi there. Welcome to Grief to Growth Podcast. Your host is Brian Smith, spiritual seeker, best-selling author, grief survivor, and life coach. Brian believes that the worst tragedies of life provide the greatest opportunity for growth. Brian says he was planted, not buried, and he is here to help you grow where you've been planted by the difficulties in life. In each episode, Brian and his guests will share what has helped them to survive and thrive. It is his sincere hope this episode helps you today.
Hi, everybody. This is Brian back with another episode of Grief to Growth. And today I've got with me Robin Landsong. And I first heard Robin's story. We were just trying to figure out. It's been a couple of years ago. It was on Sandra Champlain's show, We Don't Die. And it's Robin has a fascinating story. And she's doing really great work in terms of healing. So I want to read Robin's introduction and then we'll get started. Robin Aisha Landsong is a transformational speaker. She's a visual artist, a medicine singer, and a medical health intuitive. Robin had two near-death experiences during the Rhodesian War in 1977 when she was 8 years old. When Robin was called back to life by the medicine song of a rural Zimbabwean woman, it opened up Robin's own medicine songs, and she has given singing medicine to over 14,000 people. Robin specializes as a shamanic craniosacral therapist, and she works with people in trauma resolution, the neurobiology of connection, and restoring the natural rhythms of the body. Robin sees each person's gifts, strengths, and underlying cause of their physical, emotional, or spiritual distress. And Robin helps people regain their creativity, intuition, and embodiment. And her website is www.robinlandsong.com. That's LANDSONG.com. And as always, that'll be in the show notes. So with that, I want to welcome Robin to Grief to Growth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Rob, it is really great to have you on. As I said, I heard your story, you know, a few years ago. I'd like to review that again today. You and I have been in some classes together, so I know we've kind of met a little bit, but this is our first time talking face-to-face. So if you could start by telling me about your story that started, wherever you'd like to start.
Mm-hmm. So when I was, I grew up on the East Coast of the U.S., and unfortunately, I had parents who had lost their natural instinct to protect their children. And so I was exposed to a lot of dangerous adults. And one of those adults saw me as a vulnerable, unprotected child. And he was obviously not mentally well. And he abducted me. He came to my school at the end of the day, at the end of the school year, and took me, drugged me, and then brought me on a plane. And when I woke up again, I didn't know where I was, but I actually was in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe.
So he abducted you and took you on a plane to Zimbabwe, and that's where you woke up and had no idea where you were?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. And so what I've researched since then is that the Rhodesian Bush War at that time, mm-hmm. and that the Rhodesian government didn't have enough people to fight their side. So they were recruiting all around the world. And one of their special kind of focuses was recruiting Vietnam vets. So this is 1977. So the Vietnam War had ended. Mm-hmm. And that there was a number of Vietnam vets who, you know, were having trouble integrating. So literally, I got the 1977 Soldier of Fortune magazine that's advertising, come be a man among men. So you can come be a soldier again.
Wow. So he wasn't there to be a soldier, but he decided to take you with him.
Right. And so I'll never really know, you know, his thought process around that. One historian I spoke with proposed a theory, again, which I'll never know, is that a lot of the soldiers who were in Vietnam fathered a child with a Vietnamese woman. Mm-hmm. And then when they got deported back here, then they didn't get to bring that child with them. And so from clues of things he said, he might have just felt like, oh, I lost a daughter. I'm just going to get another one.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all, I think we try to struggle to understand what the mentally ill people do, but sometimes, frankly, we just can't. So you find yourself there. And what was life like for you then?
Since I grew up with unsafe people, I knew that he was one of the most dangerous that I have ever encountered. And I knew that my life could be ended at any moment. And so I just did the best I could to cope mm-hmm. and survive, which is a lot about doing what he wanted and kind of being what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And we've all heard of the Stockholm syndrome, where the person has to kind of basically mind meld with their abductor and just to be able to anticipate like what they're going to do or say or request. So in my healing process, it took quite a while to kind of undo that Stockholm effect and kind of be able to come back to my own perspective on it. Mm-hmm. So he did assault me, and he kicked my ribs, and the MPs came because we were actually on a military base, and I've been able to go back and stand there. I wasn't allowed to go on it, but I was able to stand there and look in through that exact place. So the MPs came and I was hospitalized, and I've also gone and found the hospital, and I found the exact bed that I was in. Hmm. And from there, sadly, no one stopped him from coming to get me from the hospital. And he took me with him to a market. And basically he kind of left me in the hands of another man. I don't know the nature of the exchange, but based on my research, I think he had 5 days of training, and then he had to go into the field and fight.
Okay.
And so he had to get rid of me.
Okay. So he left you with someone else, mm-hmm. and this person took you in. And then how was that?
He put me on a bus, and I was the only white person, and it was kind of the buses we've seen, you know, there's animals, there's people, it's overpacked.
Yeah.
And the bus broke down. And since I was just freshly out of the hospital with broken ribs, we were all instructed to get out and walk, and I couldn't keep up. And so the man who I was in his care, we'll say, pushed me along. And when he pushed on my broken ribs, I just bit him, you know, which is kind of defended animal. Mm-hmm. So he kind of was, you know, done with dealing with me. So he just left me behind. And hours later, soldiers came by and picked me up. And again, now I've done my historical research mm-hmm. and gone back twice to Zimbabwe. And now I know that for a white girl to be alone in that war, it was kind of just a matter of hours of survival.
Yeah. And
that it was a war over land and land use. And of course, you know, the history of colonialism and oppression. And what I found out is that it is likely I was actually picked up by the guerrilla soldiers. And from my perspective, you know, they're fully armed. And I thought, well, this is the end of my 8 miserable years, and it's going to be quick.
Yeah.
And for me at that time, I felt like quick is mercy, and let's just get this done. And what happened is that two of the men had an argument over me. One advocating, you know, of course, it's all in, not in the language I understand, but I understand mm-hmm. the end. And one was advocating for my life and the other was advocating for my death. Mm. And as you can imagine, kind of the stress in my nervous system, when the man who was advocating for my life kind of took me towards him like a father would do in a protective way, on the one hand, it was so much what I needed. And on the other hand, it just undid my coping. And so I just collapsed and in what we call dorsal shutdown. So in my perspective now, I have one of the most dangerous soldiers to thank for my life. So I have the enemy to thank for my life.
Yeah.
And so he took a risk and, you know, knew that my time was limited. He couldn't really keep me safe there. So he got a vehicle and transported me to a village that was right close on the border to South Africa. And his, and, you know, probably by his best guess that they would be sympathetic to a white child. So he took me there and basically dropped me off and just kind of, I guess, hoped for the best.
Okay. So here you are at 8 years old. You've been kidnapped, handed from one person to another person. That person abandons you. You get picked up by a soldier and he drops you off in a strange village.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And believe it or not, I felt free. Because I was free from the abductor, who was the absolute worst danger.
Yeah.
And so I spent the night in the tree by myself. And thank goodness I didn't know about the animals that were all around me. And in the morning, I heard women singing. And it was the first sound of hope, sound of caring, sound of life. And so I went closer. And of course, I was very threatened and very scared. But I stood on the edge of this. I hid behind a tree and I watched these women, and they were grinding food and pounding corn.
Hmm.
And they were singing. And this was the first time I had seen adult women with so much natural joy and so much generosity. And like one woman came and kind of took the food that had been ground, and the generosity and the giving, I had never seen that before.
Hmm.
And I always thought needing something was basically bothering someone else.
Wow.
And so I watched them, and then I kind of, you know, peeked out from behind the tree, and they saw me, and, you know, who knows what they thought. A lone white child, like people just didn't mix there.
Right, right.
There was like the white people who had a farm, and then there was the Black Africans, and there was really, unless they went to work for them, there was no mixing.
Right.
And, you know, this is the time period of, you know, in South Africa, there's apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought me food and water. And eventually I came out from behind the tree. And that night they gave me a sheepskin to sleep on. And I was too afraid to actually go in a hut with any of them. And it was the next day that the children came around me. And they were touching my white skin, and my hair was more blonde then. And they were, you know, kind of like, what is this? They had never really, you know, let alone touched a white girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they took me to the fire circle. And the eldest one, she was probably about 13, and I have given her the name Tanisha. And so she's so proud, and she's, you know, she can stand so regal, and I've never seen that either. And she takes ash from the fire and she starts putting it on me. Mm. And so she's making me black like them. And she's telling a story, and it's in Venda, so I can't understand it. But I get that she's storing me in. She's telling the story of, and then she came to us. And it was the first belonging I had in my life.
Wow.
And other children joined in, and they're all putting black ash on my clothes and my face and my arms. And for the first time ever, I had a feeling of welcome.
Wow. Wow.
And one of the women who had been part of the food preparation area, she came over and she was laughing and laughing and thought it was a great time. And she started singing to me and calling to me. And the drawing that's behind me is a turtle that symbolically represents her. And there's the creation myth of that the turtle rests on the, that the world rests on the back of a turtle. And mm-hmm. so I drew that, and you can see the Africa on it.
Yeah.
That my world rested on her back.
Wow.
And so she sang to me, and she melted my armor, and she was calling me to look in her eyes. And with my upbringing, I never looked adults in the eyes. And so she was calling me to kind of go against all my defenses and let me be a child. And she was offering to be my shelter.
Hmm.
And when I took the risk to look in her eyes, it was the first time I saw the eyes of a mother.
Wow.
And I literally collapsed in her arms and let her become my mama.
Wow. Now, this singing, I assume, was not in English, or did you understand what she was saying?
They don't speak English. It's Venda or some other languages.
Okay. So how did you How long were you there? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how you communicated. And
So I was abducted probably about the first week in June, and I was returned sometime in August.
Okay, so you were there for a couple of months anyway. Mm-hmm. So did this particular family take you in?
They did. And okay. There was another woman who also mothered me, and they really did. They took me in because I'm guessing they assumed that my family had been killed and that I was Rhodesian. Mm-hmm. and that my family had been killed and somehow I had been escaped. Mm-hmm. So they probably assumed I was orphaned. They had no idea I was American.
Okay.
And what I found out later is the kind of the nearest white family, that they did have a daughter about my age. And so a lot of them thought that was me.
Okay. So you're living with this family. At some point, something happened. Something triggered the near-death experience you had, right?
Mm-hmm. So I wandered a bit too far from the village, and I went to a creek where the way we usually swam, and like the two mothers had put clay on me to try and heal my bruises. So it was a really positive, safe place for me. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know was that in the field right next to where that creek was, that there was a battle starting. And being there by myself, being on the edge of where the soldiers were starting to gather for this battle, one of them spotted me. And when he saw me, I froze. And I knew that I could never make it back to the village and that maybe just running would incite him even more. And so he immediately brought up his rifle and fired. And the bullet grazed the top of my head and blew me off my feet. And I began to die of blood loss and shock.
Hmm.
And I crossed over to the other side. And there I met a series of beings. And one of them, I was still hoping to be able to get back to my family because I was still disoriented that I was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, I kind of ran to him hoping like he could help me get back to my family because they had named me Aisha and they had given me a naming ceremony.
Your family in Zimbabwe, to be clear.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when I stood in his presence, I couldn't remember why I was disturbed.
Hmm.
And his face kept changing. And it changed to people I didn't know. And then I thought, oh, I would like to show this to Atto, who was one of the men in the village that was so good to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I thought that, his face changed to Atto. And my heart bloomed open with all this love. And then his face changed again to someone I didn't know. And my heart still stayed wide open. And I thought, I'm more capable of love than I thought. Hmm. And his face changed to a lion. And he leaned his forehead and touched mine. And I could see as he sees. And it was like a living matrix with gems and golden connections, like you know, that iridescent in the spider webs.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized is that even if I lose my newfound African family, I am still connected to this whole web of life.
Wow.
And that I can strengthen my connections with my focus and my love. And that I belong to something even bigger. And it's this universal family. And when he came back from touching my forehead, my faith in him was absolute.
Wow.
And so I allowed my being to just lean into his. And when I did that, I was closer to the source that he was made of also. And so there we traveled in a tunnel of light. And we came out above the scene looking down on where my body was. And my Mami Yatan had found me. And she was holding my body and stopping the blood flow. And she was rocking and she was wailing. And I wanted to let her know, you know, I'm watching from above. I wanted to let her know I'm okay.
Hmm.
I'm pain-free. I'm all right. And I have this beautiful guide with me. And I'm totally held. And so from there, I lifted off and went upward and met more beings that purified me and took away any notion that the abuse that had happened to me in my lifetime was my fault. Mm. And as I kept going further, and I was going home to my source, and I call that the great heart. And every part of me was going to be received home. And I knew I was going back to my original source, where I felt I was like a seed syllable sung into being. And as I kept going towards this freedom, towards this spaciousness, and losing all kind of my injuries from this lifetime, and then I heard singing. And what was happening is that my mom Yetan had changed her wailing into singing. Mm-hmm. And then she had called on the ancestors in the land to sing a calling song, to find me where I was, meet me, and remind me of the medicine songs. And so her singing made it through all the veils that had closed behind me. And when it reached me, I had a choice. And hearing those singing voices, I remembered, I haven't done my purpose, which is to also be a medicine singer like her. Hmm. And so I had a choice. I could either keep going forward to the great heart, back to my original source, or I could come back, kind of to this denser plane. But then I could do my purpose of singing to others as she sang to me to restore me.
Yeah.
And so I chose to come back.
Wow. Well, as you're telling the story, Robert, I'm just like so drawn in and just so fascinated by, in your eight short years, but the pain that you experienced and the relief and the going back and the bonding with this family that you only been with for a few weeks, right? I mean, at this point, it's only been a couple of weeks you'd been there. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm reminded also as you tell the story about, near-death experiences, I hear some of them say they'll feel the prayers of the person on the site praying for them. It sounds like that the song, as you said, reached you through, even through all these veils, and reminded you that you still had something to do here. Mm-hmm. So at this point, you come back and you find yourself in your body again, I assume?
Mm-hmm. Which was, like most near-deathers say, is not a great moment. And it was really her arms around me. She was solid, and I just felt like the wind could blow through me. I felt like just kind of, dry, crackly leaves. Mm-hmm. But when they did the medicine singing for me, they made sure to do a song to clear the hatred that had come with the bullet, so that I wouldn't go through life with that hatred on my head. And so they cared for me. And unfortunately, about 2 days later, the soldiers came back and they attacked the whole village. And so one other mother was carrying me on her hip and running. Mm-hmm. And sadly, she was shot from behind. And so we both went down, and she just yelled at me to get up and keep going. And so the hardest moment for me to heal from is that I wanted to pull her with me, but yeah. I had just been shot and died from blood loss 2 days earlier.
Right.
And so I did what she said, and I kept running, and I was running towards the tree cover next to the Limpopo. And I made it to a little hill. And then as I went down the little hill, I collapsed because, I probably needed an IV, and mm-hmm. I just had blood loss a couple of days ago.
Right.
And so I had a second near-death experience. And in that, it was an entirely different experience. And I met one being, and he was still behind a veil himself. And his message to me, and he was, his skin was blue and he had a black bun and there was kind of all kinds of ornamentation around him. And I knew he was incredibly powerful, and that with one hand he could make a mountain and with the next hand he could take it down. Hmm. So he was like this intensity of creation destruction. And here I had just been through a massacre, and I didn't know if I was the only one alive or if anybody else had lived. And his message to me was, out of destruction, that makes available the ingredients for a new creation. And so when I came back to my body after receiving that message, his voice was still with me in this dense plane, in this human plane. And he commanded me to crawl forward and get away from the site of the massacre. And I had no will to live. And it was his will that just commanded me to go forward. And what he was doing is getting me to go to a well where the next day he knew that a woman would come, and a woman found me. Her name is Mia Lucy. And she washed the blood off me, and she took me back to her homestead, her village. And she took care of me, and she had the local medicine singer come and sing to me. And that's where I met her granddaughter, who is Mayamu. And they ended up kind of talking to the closest white people in South Africa and saying, well, we have this white girl and we don't know who she belongs to. And they said, well, we don't know either, but give her to us and we'll find out. And so they literally took me across the Limpopo River into South Africa and gave me to the nearest white people who were farmers. And so from my perspective, I went from going from a culture where people touch each other, there's animation, there's expression in the face. You know, I was sleeping next to other children. I was always being touched, always being sung to, to white apartheid South Africa. And the cultural shift for me, just like I wasn't being touched, I wasn't being sung to. I was being cared for. Yeah. And I had a doctor bed to sleep in, and we had running water, and we had plenty of yummy food.
Yeah.
But I needed touch, and I needed being sung to. And so I kind of again just started to die of trauma. And so I was hospitalized again. You know, maybe my head had gotten infected. So I was hospitalized in Polokwane in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And again, that was an apartheid time period. So I was in a whites-only wing. So all of a sudden, I wasn't seeing any Black people. And if I said I want to go back and be on the other side of the river with my family, you know, their reactions were not positive to that. They took away the dress that Mayamu had given me and kind of dressed me in more kind of white people clothes. So from my perspective as an 8-year-old, I was like, wait, I went from being loved to being treated as this problem that nobody wants.
Yeah.
And from there, they kind of threatened me to tell them where my parents were, because obviously they could tell I didn't have a South African accent.
Yeah.
From there, they figured out where my parents were, and some agent, we can't figure out from what agency, flew me back to Philadelphia.
Okay. So you didn't voluntarily tell them you're from Philadelphia?
No. And it's sort of like, you know, they basically said, you don't want to go to an orphanage, little girl.
Yeah.
If you have parents, tell us their names.
Yeah. So what was it like coming back? Was it like reorienting back to your family, the culture here, or everything else?
Basically, I didn't really talk much for a year. I was just in like a traumatized state. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the rule in my family, like many families that have a lot of abuse, is that if we don't talk about it, it never happens. Mm-hmm. And so when I tried to talk about it, and I might have said something like, I have to get back to my real mother. And my mom, my biological mom, she hit me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a brain injury. My brain's still swollen, and she hit me in the face. And I just thought, I remember the girl, the shell I have to be to make it here.
Yeah.
So my family never asked me what happened. We don't talk about it. It never happened. And still no one from my family will acknowledge it.
Yeah, Robin, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about people having their death experiences. And I was talking to PMA Atwater, interviewed her, you know, a couple of months ago. And adults have trouble integrating these experiences. And children have even more trouble integrating these experiences. And being a child going through the trauma that you had been through before coming in and then coming back to even more trauma, how did you manage to integrate this experience?
You know, it's funny you mentioned PMH, because that was really validating to me, because she says like 5 to 7 years for adults if they have reasonable support. And then she says 30 to 40 years for kids who don't have support. So I ended up going back to Zimbabwe 40 years after. So I went back when I was 48.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's really been writing my book that's been the big way to integrate this. And certainly I did lots of therapy and EMDR therapy, I highly recommend. And I've done all kinds of body healing techniques. And I offer those services too. But it's really been writing my book. And my husband has interviewed me for 11 years. I've been working on this book because it's been this polishing the gem. Mm-hmm. And that my commitment to my readers is that I'm going to have metabolized, made sense, made meaning of everything from my story before I deliver it to you.
Hmm.
And I just got a reading from one of my friends who's also an intuitive. And she said, it's like you've been hand making this diamond called your book to give to people and like polishing it and smoothing it for 11 years.
Yeah.
Because the first draft of it was just in a compressed, traumatized voice. And it didn't have any grace or even good sense structure. And so my husband and I've given it out to about 45 different people. And it's been amazing to get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I'm on my sixth professional editor. And so it's just needed that much work. And the book has worked me.
Right.
And the beauty is sometimes people tell me when they read it, they say, all the transformation you did while writing it is the gift that comes through. I mean, the story is interesting,
yeah,
but you can feel the transformation that went into your writing process. And that's what I need to deliver.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I talk to you and listen to you, and I can feel the transformation that you've gone through or going through, you know, coming through, and, you know, hearing, you know, again, the trauma that you went through, which is just incredible, the trauma that, you know, that most of us can't even imagine, but how that, you know, has formed you into the person that you are. And, you know, so, you know, it's also interesting to hear you say, okay, I went back and you were told you weren't, you know, ready to go because you had your mission to fulfill, but you still had to come back here to some pretty tough circumstances that you had to endure until you started fulfilling that mission.
We'll get back to Grief to Growth in just a few seconds. Did you know that Brian is an author and a life coach? If you're grieving or know someone who is grieving, his book, Grief to Growth, is a best-selling, easy-to-read book that might help you or someone you know. People work with Brian as a life coach to break through barriers and live their best lives. You can find out more about Brian and what he offers at www.grieftogrowth.com, www.grief2growth.com, or text GROWTH, GROWTH, to 31996. If you'd like to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/grieftogrowth, www.patreon.com/GRIEF2GROWTH to make a financial contribution. And now back to Grief to Growth.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, something I want to tell you about today. My podcast platform, Buzzsprout, has recently made it easier for me to allow you to support me financially. Go to www.grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. That's grieftogrowth.com/subscribe. And once you're there, you can sign up to support me financially. Now, you can do it for as little as $3 a month or, of course, as much as you'd like. If you do that, you'll get access to bonus episodes, and you'll see those in the regular feed. They'll have a lock on them. But when you become a subscriber, you'll actually get access to your own private feed, and you'll be able to listen to the regular podcast along with the bonus podcast for the subscribers. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for sharing the podcast. And I want to thank those of you who support me financially. Have a great day, and on to the episode. Yeah. So tell me about the work that you do now. How did you become a medicine singer and transformational speaker and all the things you're doing now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say just first, I want to thank all the people that helped my healing process,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, friends and therapists and body healers and massage therapists and, you know, just all the classes that I took on healing. And so it's been a real delight to be able to give back. And so what I've really done is kind of, you know, the foundation of it, the passion of it is that I've gone from being, you know, so much trauma response in my nervous system to having a lot of freedom and a lot of choice, you know, and always we're still working on. Somebody in an audience once asked, when are we done healing? And I was like, I think your last breath, and then you get renewed and start again. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So as my intuition, you know, I kind of say that like in my 20s, I was just so full of trauma content. And when I was able to bring down that trauma content.
Now, how did you become a medicine singer and transformational speaker and all the things you're doing now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say just first, I want to thank all the people that helped my healing process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, friends and therapists and body healers and massage therapists and, you know, just all the classes that I took on healing. And so it's been a real delight to be able to give back. And so what I've really done is kind of, you know, the foundation of it, the passion of it is that I've gone from being, you know, so much trauma response in my nervous system to having a lot of freedom and a lot of choice, you know, and always we're still working on. Somebody in an audience once asked, when are we done healing? And I was like, I think your last breath, and then you get renewed and start again. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So as my intuition, you know, I kind of say that like in my 20s, I was just so full of trauma content. And when I was able to bring down that trauma content, like by my kind of early 30s, mid 30s, my intuition got freed up because I was no longer just hypervigilantly scanning for danger. So as my intuition got freed up, I realized, oh, I can see inside people. I can see people's organs. I can even see cells if I focus.
Mm-hmm.
And I also get movies and stories of people's lives. And that I hold those with compassion. And that what's happening is that the part of us that wants to be witnessed, wants to be known, is communicated to me. And, you know, so I don't see this all the time. Like, not everybody I walk past.
Mm-hmm.
But we know when I have people's permission is that I see the relevant stories either in their lifetime or maybe their parents or going back generationally about what created distress, what created imbalance, what created contraction that is still limiting this person's life. And that my favorite thing to do is to help people come home to themselves, come back to their body, and just be able to live with more freedom and more choice. And one of my favorite, you know, I have like thousands of stories of fantastic transformations.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just share this one. I was in Texas at a near-death conference, and my husband and I offered a singing medicine workshop. And in the hall before the workshop, I met a person who had a near-death experience as a child. She had drowned. And she just was very blatant. She was very open. She was like, yeah, I'm just waiting to go back. And I'm not really enjoying being here. And it just kind of broke my heart. Like, oh, sweetheart, you're 60. It's a long time just that you've been like sitting in the waiting room.
Yeah.
And so fortunately, she came to the singing medicine workshop. And when it came, I call people, would you like to be sung to? And then they come in the center of the circle. And then I use my intuition and I ask, what's medicine for them today? You know, through my singing, through my reflecting them back, through seeing them. And she felt to me like she was barely here. Like her form was here, but her vitality wasn't here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just did prayer and I called to all the spirits I work with. And I was like, you got to help me on this one. You know, we got to pull it out for this one. And so I did my prayer and I began to sing to her and I asked her if I could hold her. And she said, yes. And I was holding her and I whispered in her ear, we need you to come back now. We need you here.
Mm.
And Brian, it was one of the most incredible moments in my life. I felt her come home. It was like I was holding a shell and boom, all of a sudden I was holding a three-dimensional person. And I thought, well, that went well. I'm going to do it again. And I said, we need you here. Come back. And she did it again. She brought her vitality back into her body. And, you know, the whole room was weeping. I was weeping. She was weeping. The whole room, especially all the near-deathers, were just And so I, you know, held her for a while, and then I backed up and I looked at her face and I said, "Do you need help back to your chair?" And she said, "Where am I?" So I helped her back to her chair, and like three other near-deathers like came and sat right by her and like snuggled up to her. And I thought, ooh, this might be a tough integration for her later. But I saw her later in the hall, and she was like hugging people and like saying hello to everyone, and like this like super extrovert, so happy to be here.
Wow.
So that's my favorite thing to do is, you know, whether it's trauma or near-death experience or generational trauma. Mm-hmm. Like, I am just amazed how many people I work with like, you know, World War One, World War Two is still this compression, this distress that's still alive in their body. And so that's where I love to use my intuition to help people figure out the mystery of where's the original source. And then I use my compassion practices and the craniosacral therapy to just be with it, breathe with it, have the cranial rhythm, smooth it out. And the transformations are incredible. It's so my honor that I get to be part of that. You know, I think I've worked with over 14,000, I've done about 14,000 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And one, I'm changed because I get to practice compassion 14,000 times. And my brain is completely changed by getting to witness and be with people. And so it's just a real privilege to do my work. And the singing medicine, of course, comes from my near-death experience and being sung to myself. And that's the real key I've discovered in the past, like 4 years or so, that I also get medium information in terms of being able to hear through the veil and hear the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's the singing that can really bring that through. And I started doing groups for helping parents heal. And I work with like four or five people from that group. And there's one woman I sang to, and her son who had died was a very kinesthetic person. So I wasn't getting any visuals. I wasn't getting a lot of story. But when I sang to her, she said, "I felt my son move through me. I felt his love physically in my body." And I thought, it's perfect. You know, he's kinesthetic. Of course, it was going to come through a felt sense.
Yeah.
And perfect that she felt it, because it doesn't matter what I experience. It's about what the other person receives.
Yeah. Well, you know, you said something earlier that really caught my attention about the woman who didn't feel like she'd fully come back after a near-death experience. And I heard you say something about that in a video that you've done recently. And I'm reading a book right now called The Team, and it's about it's written by this woman channeling her mother who's crossed to the other side. But I hadn't really heard this concept that sometimes our spirits don't seem to be fully integrated with our bodies. And sometimes they're kind of, you know, checked out a little bit, and we're more there than we are here. So it sounds like you're helping call people back to be fully present in their body. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and honestly, it's like our biology doesn't do well without that vitality being home.
Yeah.
And I'm not crazy about the term soul retriever, because our souls are fine.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
It's our physical bodies that need that vitality, that spirit coming back in.
Yeah, we're just not fully connected, right? It's kind of...
Right. And that for some near-deathers I've worked with, you know, they're still so up and out, like they have the door still open, which is fine, but then they don't actually really commit to being here.
Mm-hmm.
And one woman I worked with, it's like every business she tried to start, it didn't work. You know, people couldn't relate to her because she still was like 1 foot over on the other side.
Yeah.
Which I can understand. It's very pleasant, but it doesn't make for a committed lifetime here.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi there. I'm really excited to tell you about my latest ebook. It's 4 lessons that you can learn from the near-death experience without going through all the trouble of dying to learn them. I've been studying NDEs for several years now. I am completely convinced that not only are they 100% real, but that there's some very universal wisdom that we can get from the near-death experience. And I've distilled that down in this book into 4 short lessons. And I've also given you all the reasons why I believe the NDEs are absolutely real. So go to www.grieftogrowth.com/NDE lessons to pick it up for free. www.grief2growth.com/NDE lessons. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah,
I, I think that's something that, you know, you mentioned helping parents heal, and I work with Helping Parents Heal and have for about the last 4 years or so. And as parents going through grief, and I've said it myself, I'm half here and half there because my daughter, I feel like my daughter is there. And I think it could be a challenge to be fully present in this life when we've got so much invested on the other side. So I think it's important, though, that we know that while we're here, we're meant to be here.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And just the, you know, all the mindfulness practices. And I've been really doing a lot of research lately on self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And just, I'm really struck by how much self-criticism and self-beratement, when we can move that over to self-criticism, I mean, I'm sorry, self-compassion.
Right.
That's actually a place, you know, obviously a much more psychologically well place to be. We actually have more motivation and we're actually more present for others. And it's Kristen Neff that I've been reading. And she talks about that when we're in like a shame dive or, you know, a self-beratement, you know, party, mm-hmm. that we're really very self-focused and we're not actually available for other people. Mm-hmm. But when we can do the mindfulness practices and the self-compassion practices and move it over here, that's when we can be steady and be more accountable. And when I did an interview with Jeff, my friend Jeff Olson, who's also a near-death experiencer, mm-hmm. I think Jeff's superpower, and I love naming people superpower, I love seeing people's strengths. So we did this interview together, and then I called him afterwards and I said, well, you know, your superpower is accounting, abiding with, because I don't, you know his story?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, he was driving the car mm-hmm. and unfortunately he fell asleep. Mm-hmm. And the resulting accident, he began to cross over, his wife died and his infant died.
Yeah.
His other son lived. And I mean, to sit with that and go forward from there. And so he doesn't crash, you know, I'm sure in the, you know, for the first decade or whatever, 15 years, like sitting with, abiding with what happened, he fell asleep, but not going into self-beratement. Mm-hmm. And so he just stays right in the center, abiding with the truth. This yeah. is what happened.
Yeah.
And it's not into self-pity and it's not into self-beratement. It's right in the center, abiding with. And so that's when we have choice and that's when we have freedom of how we respond. When we're out of our body, we're super reactive and we don't even know why, because we never sensed our own emotion. And so the key to being present is emotions are chemical events in our body that generate sensation. That sensation goes up to our brain and our brain interprets it and says, my stomach just tightened up. That means I'm anxious. Why am I anxious? Well, is it because I'm in physical pain and I don't know when it's going to stop, or because somebody I'm uncomfortable with just entered the room? So when we can, you know, be that mindful, be that present to body sensation, you know, be present with what are our thoughts and all the meditation practices that are so useful for increasing our brain health, that the whole key to all of it, not only is greater physical health, but it's choice and freedom to not just be reactive from our trauma response our whole life. And my view is the people who abused me as a child, they already stole my childhood. They're not going to steal my adulthood. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I invested so much in my healing process really early on. Mm-hmm. It was because I wanted the rest of my life for me.
Yeah.
So I could show up and do my divine assignment.
Yeah.
And it's my favorite thing to just help people do their divine assignment.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Be home in themselves enough to even have a felt sense of what that is.
Yeah. So let's talk about what is craniosacral therapy. That's a big word. So what is that?
Yeah, it's not actually a very descriptive term. So the cranial system is the brain and the mm-hmm. spine. And there's fluid, cerebrospinal fluid, that goes around the whole brain and down the whole spine. And that has a motion to it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a big pump, like the heart moves the blood in a very, you know, big pump. So you can easily feel like, oh, there's my heartbeat. So the cranial fluid is, it's more variable and it's more subtle. So not everybody can feel it. So it takes a practitioner who can kind of really get still and just be able to tap into that to be able to even sense it. Mm-hmm. And so it's an amazing expression of where's the health and where's the distress in the nervous system and then the whole body. And so after listening to that for, you know, so many thousands of sessions, and so my body is a antenna. And so my nervous system is having a communication with this other nervous system. And so I'm helping people go from agitated and not being able to self-sense over to self-regulation. And again, that's where the freedom is when we can self-regulate. Mm-hmm. And it's going from sympathetic response, the fight, flight, over to a healthy state of parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest or friend and befriend. Mm-hmm. And then that's where we can get to, and this is where I love polyvagal theory, that's when we can get to ventral vagal, which is connection. So you and I right now are in ventral vagal. We're hearing each other, we're seeing each other, we're, you know, there's a level of trust and safety and rapport, and we're able to have a sense of each other. And so that's ventral vagal, where we can care about another's inner world. Mm-hmm. So I see you. I get that you have an internal world, and it's an important one to me.
Right.
And I'm going to do my best to be careful with it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to at least try to be careful with your inner world.
Yeah. So describe singing medicine to me. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. So I can actually just do some.
Yeah, it'd be great.
And so basically I'm asking, what's medicine for this person today? Mm-hmm. And so it varies. And so I'm listening to the song that's in the land. I'm listening to my medicine songs, and I'm doing my best to listen to the song that you were born with.
Hmm.
And so every now and again, you know, in a couple minutes time, I can touch upon that. And people say, I already knew that song. How did I know that song? I'm like, what's your song?
Yeah.
In the human jukebox and playing it back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let me just tap in for a moment.
Is awesome. Wow. I could feel that. I mean, I really could feel that in my body.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about that. What did you notice?
You know, it's interesting. I was reminded of like Native American, which I'm not, but I've always been attracted to that culture. So I kind of heard that. I felt really calm. It was almost like a buzzing going through my body. I mean, I literally felt it in my body. I mean, not just in my ears. It touched me in a level I was really hard to put into words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what a lot of people say. And, you know, and just, I just feel so honored to be able to, that this is my, what I've been given.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really awesome. But, and I was noticing earlier, cause we talked and I know right now nobody can travel. So we can't see people face to face, but you can still do your work remotely. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. COVID has forced me. I've like started doing groups, and I already had did distance sessions, but of course now they're all distance sessions, but it's forced me to start doing groups. So I just did a singing medicine mentorship group. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I do strengths reading groups. So I read people's strengths or what's kind of blocking them from their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe how great it is. They're just small. They're 5 people. And, you know, it's like I have somebody from France, somebody from, you know, North Carolina, somebody from close near me. And in like an hour and 15 minutes, people get bonded. And one of my teachers, James Gordon, who's just an amazing trauma resolution expert, he talks about the big thing that we're healing is loneliness. And people are sometimes lonely for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're lonely for connection to those immediately around them. And so many people are lonely for community. And so doing these, he says, you know, one-on-one sessions are great, and because you can build rapport and keep the safety and keep the container just for them. Mm-hmm. But he said doing groups is addressing that loneliness for community.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm just, you know, oddly enough, I'm kind of grateful for COVID to make me do the, you know, 15 hours of behind the scenes work to get groups going and just to make it happen. Cause I get to connect to people. And it's also, honestly, it's a lower price point for people to also work with me when I do it in groups too. So that makes it more readily available to a broader spectrum of people.
Yeah. And you can reach more people, but you know, it's, you know, I think we all long to be seen, and you talked about that and we hear it in your story. I mean, it's just the fact that you bonded with these people that in the village, that you were only there for a few weeks, you know, but it just, you wanted to be seen, you wanted to be touched, you wanted to be held. And, you know, like you said, the food and the stuff, you know, maybe the accommodations weren't so nice, but that's not what we long for deep down inside. We all want to be seen and to be respected and to be honored. And I mean, you didn't even speak their language, so it wasn't what they were saying to you. So I think that's really telling on a very deep level of what we all really long for.
Mm-hmm. And the key thing too, in the returning back, you know, like I said, I've been back twice, and I got to reunite with my Emma, mm-hmm. granddaughter of the woman who picked me up from the well. And so I just like to encourage people. I do have a video online that has that reunion with my Emma.
Oh, really? Okay.
40 years. And literally it was like, literally it was running to each other and embracing. And, you know, she's this big, strong woman, and she picked me up and rocked me. And we purposely told no one where my bullet wound was, because we wanted to make sure that other people, you know, just that it was just people who actually really knew me then. And we mm-hmm. could clarify that. And she bent me forward and she checked exactly where my bullet wound was. And it was like the biggest validation I had in my entire life. So it was so healing to go back. And I went back a second time last year, and they did a community ceremony, and they brought me right into the center. And our hosts were like, "You've lived here for 40 years. They wouldn't even let us come to one of these, let alone invite us into the center to dance." Mm-hmm. So it was an incredible honor. And you know, and my Emu was just like hugging me like I was her baby sister. And so there's a real honoring that I am doing through this book, that they took incredible risk to save my life. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely not be alive. And when my Emu's grandmother found me and other people saw that she had a wounded white child, they said, "Don't bother with her. It's not worth it." And they had a good point. It was incredibly dangerous for them to have me. Mm-hmm. And she said, "I won't throw her away. She's a living human being."
Yeah.
And because of her courage, I'm alive.
Yeah. So I've got to ask you, Robin, so you're doing singing medicine now. Do you think it was meant for you to be there? Do you think that it was meant for you to be in that village and to find these people?
I've had astrology readings where people have said, "Oh, you've been with them for lifetimes. And, you know the group, the kind of rural, you know, village ritual setting better than you know an American life," mm-hmm. which matches how I feel, because sometimes I feel like, why am I an American? Why am I here?
Yeah. It's wild, because you think about how quickly you integrated into that. I mean, it's like you said, "I'm home." You're from Philadelphia. You end up as 8-year-old in an African village in Zimbabwe, and you're like, "I'm home." And it's obviously you were there for a couple of weeks, but it's made a huge impact on your life, your art, your work, your whole outlook on everything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's who we bond with, that we respect, that we form our worldview around.
Yeah.
And that all kinds of research shows kids who are being abused just need one adult to see them and get them. Mm-hmm. And that kid will frame their worth around that connection. And then, you know, as PMH has researched, that kids who have a near-death experience will bond with the beings on the other side and frame themselves around that also.
Yeah. Yeah. So how about your birth family? How do you feel about being, was that a plan also, or how do you integrate that now?
I kind of make the joke that when I was incarnating, you know, like when you're standing at the gate, you know, and there's other people kind of standing at the gate, that I got competitive with the person next to me and was like, "I'm going to pick her for my mom. Oh, And then I'm also going to take him from my dad. And my guys are like, wait a minute. You know, and just like, and then I'm going to get abducted. And then I'm going to, that's my way to get back to Africa to meet with my friends over there.
Yeah.
So that's my joking way. I couldn't joke about that. When if you'd said that to me when I was 20, I'd be like, I didn't pick my parents.
Yeah.
But you know, now that I have all this healing, decades of healing, I can make a joke about it. I think I just got foolishly competitive with the person next to me. I was like, I'm going to learn so much about trauma recovery in this lifetime.
Yeah. We'll pack it all in, right?
Right. I'm on like the fast forward. I'm going to get a PhD in trauma before I'm six.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because my wife and we believe in this now too. And I was telling you earlier, my daughter, you know, passed away like 5 years ago, and I'd never even heard of soul planning until that happened. But we were talking about someone else in our family, and I won't share anything too personal, but you know, multiple marriages and many, more than one child, you know, passing, four, as a matter of fact. Wow. And we were just talking about her life. We're like, why would anybody plan all this in one lifetime? But I think sometimes as souls, we get overly ambitious. It's like, yeah, let me just do it all this one time around.
Right. Yeah. My motto now is like, I'm going to learn through joy. I'm going to learn through pleasure. That's my plan.
Yeah.
You know, creator doesn't always listen to my plan, but you know, that's my, like, one of my friends was like, you know, oh, I'm ill. I'm going to learn through illness. I'm like, great. That's good. I get that. And I'm going to learn through going camping, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's as we see these things, and as we see them play out and we can see the plan, then, you know, we can kind of laugh about them. And when we have that higher perspective, like you have now, because once you've had a near-death experience, you understand all this is temporary. And as bad as it gets, you know, we're all going to go home, you know, one day again. And so I think we can maybe keep it a little bit better in perspective and be more joyful even as we're going through the difficult times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, with that too, that fully committing here makes it more available to get the lessons, to turn over the difficulties into the gem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Robin, if people want to work with you, they can connect you through your website.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's robinlandsong.com. Again, I'll put that in the show notes. And I guess you're available for group sessions now and mm-hmm. for remote things while you can't travel.
Right. And then, I really look forward to when my book is out, COVID's over, and I really love touring and getting to do groups live and meet people in person. So, but between here and there, I have, you know, when we get done here, I'm going to make a whole bunch more groups available on my schedule.
Awesome. That sounds great. Robin, I'm glad we finally got to meet kind of face to face. I'm sure one day we'll run each other in physical life, but this is close for now.
Yeah, definitely. And you're in San Diego?
I'm in Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio. And where, I don't even know where you are. Where are you?
Olympia, Washington, below Seattle.
Oh, okay, cool, cool. Well, Robin, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you. I'm looking forward to your book. I'm sure it'll be well-polished when it comes out, and maybe I'll have you back when the book's released.
Oh, thank you so much, Brian. I appreciate that. And thank you for your work in the world.
All right, you have a great afternoon.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the episode. I want to make it really easy for you to reach me. So just send me a text to 31996 and simply text the word growth, GROWTH. In fact, you can right now just say, hey, Siri, send a message to 31996. And when Siri asks you what you want to send, just say growth. You can do the same thing with OK Google. Thanks a lot. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for listening to Grief to Growth. Brian hopes that you find this episode helpful and will come back for future episodes. Brian's best-selling book, Grief to Growth, Planted, Not Buried, is a great resource for anyone who is coping with grief or knows someone who is. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support it, there are three things you can do to help. The first is to share the podcast with someone that you think it will help. The second is to go to iTunes, rate, and review the episode. The third way you can support the podcast is by becoming a patron. Head over to www.patreon.com/grief2growth. That's patreon.com/grief, the number 2, growth, and sign up to make a small monthly donation. Patrons get access to exclusive bonus content and knowledge that you are helping to spread the message of grief to growth. For more about Brian and Grief to Growth, visit www.grieftogrowth.com.
Hey there, if you liked this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you liked. If you didn't like this episode, come on over and talk about it. Let me know what you didn't like. Go to grieftogrowth.com/community and look for Talk About the Podcast. I'll see you there.